Sociopathy.
Can we define that?
Sure. So the more common term is a sociopath. So sociopathy is the condition of being a sociopath. Sociopaths are individuals that have very low capacity for empathy. They do not display normal love. They do not appear to experience remorse. They may experience regret. You know, a person, if you back your car into something, you will feel regret whether you're a sociopath or not, because you have to deal with the aftermath. But, you know, if you run over somebody's pet, if you're normal, you will feel terrible at the pain you've caused. And if you're a sociopath, you may feel very little beyond annoyance.
Do you think that that's a disorder?
No, I think it makes very little sense to think of it as a disorder. And I'll tell you why. I mean, the first thing is the commonality of it. So it seems to be that somewhere between 1% and 4% of the population is sociopathic. And that's a very high, a high number for a disorder. And it could be that you have something like, you know, lead in the water could cause 1% to 4% of the population to be, you know, mentally retarded in some recognizable way, but you wouldn't find it broadly distributed across an entire culture in this way. It's also true that we see sociopaths in many regards rising to the top of economic hierarchies and political hierarchies. So it's conspicuous that something that we have wanted to label as a disorder seems to be like a superpower for a certain number of people. So disorder is probably not the right category. I also think we draw too starkly the line between sociopaths and the rest of us. I think essentially all of us are sociopathic in some regards with respect to some things, and probably we have to be this way. So we will all recognize that we can hear about the suffering of a population that is remote from us, either in space or in time, and we can feel very little, even if in the abstract what is happening to that population is frightening or abhorrent to us. We may be able to hear about it and then go on about our day, you know, go buy a coffee or whatever, where we could, you know, we could have had our lives pivot around the discovery that there were people suffering, and yet it only captures our attention momentarily. So that strikes me as the experience of being sociopathic, largely because the population that we're talking about is too far for us to do anything productive, and so it wouldn't make sense for us to feel the emotion deeply, because it would be disruptive of things that we actually do have influence over. I think it is also really important to grapple with the lesson, I would say, of something like an organized crime leader. An organized crime leader, if the narratives we have about these folks is right, may very well love their family passionately, and they may go very far out of their way to provide benefits and to protect their families from harm. And at the same time, they may be able to turn off their feelings of sympathy or empathy with people that they have to harm in order to engage in the criminal activity that they engage in. And so when we see somebody who is in a position of control in an organized crime network give an order that does harm to innocent people, we think this must be a sociopath. But that doesn't square with the definition of sociopath and with somebody who goes home to their family and has a normal familial relationship with them. I think this is a much richer landscape than we give it credit for, and we should think very carefully about the fact that people have a sociopathic capacity in order to function normally, so as not to be overwhelmed by the huge amount of suffering in the world, and so as not to be too focused on events or circumstances too far or too powerful to do anything about, and that when we refer to sociopaths, we're really talking about people who are obligate, who have no choice and no capacity to tap into the suffering of others when need be, and that is a special case. But there's no reason to think that just because it's at the far end of a continuum of, you know, how tapped into other people's emotional states an individual is, that it is suddenly a disorder once you get to the end of the continuum. I would imagine in ancestral circumstances that there are cases in which effectively one might be of value to one's lineage in a form that was that couldn't be disrupted by observing suffering. Soldiers on a battlefield, for example, might be very effective if they could tune out the immense amount of suffering around them and do their job in a more or less mechanical fashion. So I do wonder if the truth of sociopaths is that in ancestral circumstances they would have been pointed outward so that their sociopathic tendencies would have been a benefit to their lineage because of what they could do to competing groups, and that what we are seeing, the reason we think of this as a disorder, is that people's sociopathic powers are turned chaotically, and some of them are turned, you know, in close quarters against people who are part of the in-group and therefore are not supposed to be the target of this pattern, but that it really is an adaptation just deployed in a way that doesn't make any sense.
You're using these words, sympathy and empathy. What do you mean by that?
Well, in this case, I've used them somewhat interchangeably because it requires some careful thought to see why they should be defined in the way they should be defined. But in a formal sense, sympathy is empathy with an extra characteristic. Empathy is, in my language, it is the capacity to feel the emotions of another by taking the data of their circumstances and running it through one's own mental architecture as if you were there. Sympathy, you do the same thing with the acknowledgement that you're effectively on the same team as the entity, the person, or the creature with whom you are sympathizing. So the example that I think makes this clear is we empathize with people to know what they're going to do because that provides advantages evolutionarily. That's true whether the person that you're empathizing with is your ally or your enemy. So it's very important, for example, to be able to empathize with Hitler in the bunker as the Allies approach, right? You can understand exactly why he puts a gun to his head and shoots himself because he knows what's coming. But you shouldn't sympathize with him. He was a monster and he deserves no sympathy whatsoever. So the empathy is a tool, it's a means to an end to discover what another individual is likely to do so that you can position yourself relative to that behavior. Sympathy is empathizing with somebody with whom you have allegiance, and therefore, one feels the pain of somebody on their team when that person has experienced a misfortune personally. One feels some fraction of that pain themselves. And so sympathy is the same pathos, you feel the same way, whereas, you know, in the case of your enemy, if you're empathizing with them, you may feel exactly the opposite with respect to what's happened. They may experience a misfortune and you may feel joy at the fact that they've screwed up. So you don't feel the same emotion. You understand, you feel the emotion that they feel, you correctly predict it, but your reaction to it may be very different. A sociopath who does very well may be very good at predicting the behavior and feelings of others without feeling them themselves. So they would lack sympathy, but they may be capable of empathizing. I think this is a place that we actually get sociopathy wrong. We imagine that they are incapable of empathy because there are certain places where they are a bit tone deaf. There are certain experiences in being a human being that are not usually described very well, and so a sociopath may have a hard time picking up what it really would be like to have that emotional experience. So things surrounding love and grief and things like that may be a bit hard for them to put their fingers on, but in general they may be very attuned to what somebody's psychological state is because somebody else's psychological state may constitute an opportunity or a hazard to them, and being aware of it is useful even just mechanically.
So their empathy only extends to the point where usefulness ends?
Well, actually I would say it a little differently. I would say the empathy that I see sociopaths being best at is learning the lessons of emotional states that are visible. And to the extent that an emotional state is difficult to see into. I mean, think of how confusing profound grief is. Profound grief is just the most remarkably complex state where, you know, at one moment you're, you know, completely lost in despair, and then 10 minutes later you're doing something productive and you're not thinking about the loss. And so that oscillation has to be bewildering if you've never experienced, because it seems like, you know, being productive, it puts the lie to the fact that you were debilitated only moments ago. And, you know, only if you've experienced that and you know how real it is to oscillate between being focused on this terrible loss and being in another mindset, doing something else and not thinking about it, only if you've done that do you realize that that transition is even possible, let alone the common experience of grief. So, you know, when a sociopath sees this, not having felt the despair at the loss of somebody that they loved, I think they think we're playing or something, or that maybe that's the evidence that we're not really as despairing as we appear to be in that phase or something. So anyway, it can be very revealing when you get to those few places in life where it's rare to see a really good description of the experience. Those are places that a sociopath would have a very difficult time simulating the experience, because nothing has described what it's really like. I suspect we can do a brilliant job with sociopathy, but that we can't deploy the solution on a population that's already gone through development and hope to be very effective with it. That what we would need to do is understand what the frame of mind of somebody is as they switch between their sociopathic and their empathic mode, and then train that switch so that it is tuned to the realities of life. And I would say, with respect to the obligate sociopath, that ideally a civilization that functions should provide no profit to an individual for externalizing harm onto other people. And if you actually took that seriously, such that there was no opportunity to get ahead by hurting people, then a sociopath would not find opportunities that the rest of us find troubling. They would be corralled into behaviors that were at least not harmful. And so they might be harder to recognize, because their motivations for doing something might be different from what another person might be motivated by. But the behavior that resulted might be very similar, because there would be no profit in harming people and walking away without feeling bad about it. Building systems that don't reward that behavior ought to be a focus at every scale. The price that we pay at every scale for people's betrayals of each other is very, very high. And frankly, if you want civilization to function well, you want it to produce the stuff of well-being at the highest rate possible, so that everybody has the experience of living in an abundant world. And that takes a good bit of engineering to make that a stable state, so that people don't capture more than their share of the well-being and turn it into machinery of power. I think we should use developmental environments to increase the degree to which we sympathize with each other. In other words, I think we have inherited from our ancestors a capacity for sympathy that is too narrow, and that it is very important that we be able, for example, to sympathize with generations yet unborn, because we, unlike our ancestors, have the power to destroy their environment. So in some sense, we need to be able to feel the harm that we do to people 10, 12 generations down the road in order to protect them adequately from us. Our tools are such that we can wreck civilization in a single generation, and so the degree to which this needs to be emphasized is greater than any ancestral group will likely have intuited, but that's where we are. And so in some sense we have to alter the developmental landscape, not only to be healthy, but to be modified for the new realities that being a modern human being has handed us. People who have no capacity to tap into the emotions of others are obviously a special hazard, and we need to watch out for it. But, I think the story of human variation is a rich and sometimes a difficult story, and that the desire to, to do away with dyslexics or, people who have other kinds of neurological diversity is a mistake. I would be hesitant to say that we should do anything extreme with respect to people on a continuum, but we do want to rule out the behaviors in which people get ahead by producing harm for others. At the same time, learning what developmental experiences cause a person to become compassionate is probably something we should know, and as soon as we know what makes people compassionate, I would love to see it induced in more people at a greater level.
There we go.
All right. Hold on, I may need to kill this
mosquito.
Oh, that
wasn't a sound test.
No, that was a mosquito test. And it passed, unfortunately. Yes!
Our mosquitoes, would you call them
sociopaths? No, they're chronic empaths, and they're just trying to tap into your inner essence. Yeah, the feels are incredible. So there is an issue. People are very sensitive about arrogance, and the term has a justly negative connotation. And the term humility humbleness has a very positive connotation. And while I was teaching, I always was concerned that the negative reputation of arrogance and the positive reputation of humbleness was a danger to my students. And at the same time, I didn't want to argue to them that being arrogant was a good thing, because it's not. We justly dislike arrogant people. But if you have to err in one direction or the other, it makes sense to err in the direction of arrogance. And the reason is this. We all have the capacity to do things. If we look at the things that we might be capable of doing, and we say, well, probably I couldn't accomplish that one. If we take the humble approach, then we will shoot low, and we will never discover what we're actually truly capable of. If you overestimate what you might be capable of, well, then you are in danger of not reaching what you thought you were going to accomplish, but you will at least discover the limits of your capacity. So if you have to err in one of these directions, you want to err in the direction of overestimating what you may be capable of rather than underestimating it, just simply so that you discover what you can do. And I've always wondered if the value, the social value that we put on being humble, was actually a mechanism to get people to self-sabotage. In other words, I don't want students to be humble. What I want them to be is accurate in assessing what they have accomplished and what it means. And in setting their goals, I want them to set goals high, and then maybe they surprise themselves and they exceed them. But if they've really set the goals high, maybe they don't quite achieve what they've set out to achieve, but at least they discover what they're capable of, and maybe they discover what they're really interested in. Whereas if everybody in the room is busy being humble and advertising that, that they're not arrogant, then we have really no idea what those individuals could do or what the room is capable of. So essentially, I think people should stop penalizing what sounds to them like arrogance, because it is a sort of generic stigma that accompanies people who believe in themselves that causes us not to find our way out of various bottlenecks. In other words, we need people to contemplate the possibility that they are capable of things that, if they say it out loud, many will regard them as arrogant. But we need people to contemplate these things and to figure out whether they are in fact capable of doing them in order for us to escape
our current set of predicaments. So, I don't know, give people a break as they assess what they might be capable of. And for God's sake, when you're raising kids or teaching students, don't teach them to be humble, right? You don't want them to be nasty, but teaching them to imagine that they are capable of less than they are actually capable of is educational malpractice.
I've run into, in the creative world, I've run into people often mistaking ambitiousness with pretentiousness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird in the art world, because you have to be a little pretentious, and pretentious more has to do with what you seem to be rather than what you're trying to be. And so there's this optics, you know, like it's good to have inner humility. You know, there's positives to that. It's good to have, I don't know if arrogance is the right term. I would use more ambition or like you said, like aiming higher.
Well, I'm not defending arrogance. I don't like arrogant people any more than the next person, but I often think that those who are dismissed as arrogant aren't really arrogant. What they are is ambitious in some, you know, there's kinds of ambition that I really don't especially like, but somebody who is ambitious in the sense of trying to discover what might be possible, I don't want to get in that person's way. And I also don't want to imagine that I understand more about their process of discovering something new than I understand. I understand my process to an extent, but I'm inclined to give somebody who might have extraordinary capacity room to go about doing what they do in some way that may not make sense to me, because I'm interested in seeing what they can accomplish. We're all enhanced if they accomplish something good. And you know, the irony here is that once somebody has succeeded in demonstrating that they have high capacity in some sense, once somebody has generated the object that nobody else could build, then we elevate their story. So it doesn't make sense for us to give them a hard time as they're trying to accomplish the thing, and then as soon as they've demonstrated that we were wrong and they were right about their ability to do it, then to turn them into heroes. At some level, we ought to give them room on the front end and give them a break, because frankly, almost all of the people whose stories we circulate with respect to having changed the way things function in some positive direction, almost all of those people are weird, and many of them broken in some way that actually gave them some particular capacity that's above and beyond what the rest of us do. So I must say I have a pet peeve about a system that just sort of generically encourages people to say out loud that they don't believe in themselves above some relatively common level. That's a mistake. I want to know what you think you might, you know, I want to know your wildest idea and what your plan is for figuring out if it's true. And if you're constantly reviewing whether or not it would sound arrogant to even discuss such an idea, then you're self-sabotaging. And I guess what I don't want to do is I don't want to see self-sabotage taught to people as a sophistication. It's not sophisticated to self-sabotage. It is sophisticated to figure out what you might be capable of and then try and discover whether you were right. I think my brother quotes, I think it's Jim Watson, as saying something very close to, if you are going to attempt to accomplish something truly new, you will by definition be working on something that you're not qualified to work on. And you know,
well, the qualification itself doesn't exist.
The qualification itself doesn't exist. And so at some level you're giving yourself permission. And you know, it's one thing if somebody's life depends, you know, if you're a surgeon and you have some clever idea for some new way to do something, life and limb may depend on whether your understanding is accurate, and so you have a different burden. But if you're, you know, if you're a scientist and you have a kind of an out there idea about something that might be right, that might provide a lot of power if we could find it, and you hear in your mind people dismissing you as arrogant. That's a terribly hobbling thing to imagine. And so we ought to give people a break, and we ought to realize that working backwards from the stories that we like about people who accomplished things that others said couldn't be done, that those stories all involved people who believed in themselves in a way that if you forced them to say it out loud, you might recoil from, you know, well, the Wright brothers thought they were gonna win the battle to get to heavier than air flight, and they did. And I mean, I love the Wright brothers story because A, we know so much about what they did, and B, you know, it's interesting that they were brothers, and you know, we have a lot of documentary evidence of how they overcame all of the obstacles along the way. But at some level, they got very comfortable with the idea that they were going to beat a problem that had stymied so many other people. And we rightly herald them for it. You can imagine contemporaries. If you didn't know whether the Wright brothers were going to succeed or fail, you could imagine that they were just arrogant guys who, for some reason, thought that they were going to take to the skies like birds, you know, and that was hubris, and it's not.
Is there some benefit to having that social resistance as somebody who's creative, or as, and creative in the broadest sense, somebody who's chasing down possibilities? Is there some sort of positive to be gotten from the ridicule that one receives, or those being considered a kook or arrogant or anything like that? Or you think that?
That's a good question. I think there are a couple things going on. There are circumstances, maybe within a tight-knit group of people who are trying to accomplish something together. Some individual might try to gain more control over the project than was warranted by their relative capacities or something like that. In which case, their arrogance would be counterproductive. And so it might be that that's where the penalty was generated, was that there are certain contexts in which it is not a question of an individual assessing their own capacity. It's the individual over-assessing their capacity relative to other people in the same project who might be given the resources. So in other words, it could be a competitive modality rather than a question of what you really believe you yourself are capable of. It could be you're claiming capacity that you don't really have when somebody else might have that capacity, and they will be denied the resources because of your arrogance. Mm-hmm. So it might be that, and it also might be that it creates a kind of it might fuel certain kinds of folks. In other words, being told that you're over-assessing what you're capable of, you know, it does get under your skin a little bit, and you kind of feel like, I'll show them, you know. I don't know if that's where it comes from, but it's certainly in a world where people who have done things that make their names famous eventually are often people who have imagined that they could do what others could not do, it might not be surprising to find that the accusation has less impact on those folks than it does on other folks.
So humility becomes a negative and arrogance a positive when an individual is facing a problem. But then humility becomes a positive and arrogance a negative when a group is working together. Like, that's where the value kind of shifts, you think?
Probably. I mean, I should be really clear. I'm not defending arrogance. I really don't like arrogant people, but I will imagine that arrogance is what's going on in somebody's case only when there's good evidence that they're really overestimating what they're capable of in a way that they should be aware of. If we're talking about some realm that I don't know anything about, and somebody argues that they may be able to accomplish something that sounds a little far-fetched to me, I'm not really in a good position to assess whether they are deluding themselves, or whether they are accurately shooting for something that I should, as a spectator, be hoping that they can accomplish. And I don't want to penalize them based on the fact that most of the time when somebody makes a fantastic claim, they're probably wrong. Because, I mean, I think it's like this. Most of the time, an extraordinary claim is likely to be incorrect. But all of the claims that matter started out as extraordinary claims. So all of the important stuff is in that set in which most of the stuff is garbagey in one way or another. But it's a fool who goes around punishing the whole set because 99% of what's in it is garbage if 100% of what's awesome is also in that set. Because then you're just stigmatizing the awesome just reflexively. And that's just logically a mistake.
So be outrageous in conception, but be willing to admit that most of your outrageousness is completely outrageous in the end. Some of it.
Well, in interacting with really interesting, ultra-high capacity people, I do think it's fair to say that to a person, I believe, they have a way of phrasing things that allows you to know that they spot the unlikeliness of what they are claiming might be true at the same time that they let you know why they think the limit might not really be the limit. In other words, they evidence that they are not unaware of why they are unlikely to succeed. They evidence that they are aware of it and they still think they might succeed for some reason that they can spell out to one degree or another. And so I guess what I would say is, if I see the evidence that the person is aware of all of the things that I'm aware of that make me think they are unlikely to succeed, and yet they still think they might, I'm listening, right? If they evidence that they are unaware of the difficulty, you know, if, let's put it this way, if somebody has an idea for a perpetual motion machine and they do not start their argument by explaining that they understand the physical reason that a perpetual motion machine should not exist, then that suggests they're just a kook. On the other hand, if they say, well, there's a lot of free energy in the universe, and I believe I've found a mechanism that can capture it in a way that isn't exactly perpetual motion, yet it functions an awful lot like it, well, that claim is really unlikely to be true. On the other hand, they've just told me that they understand the obstacle, and they are still thinking about it for a reason.
So there's evidence of competency that comes packaged with the claim.
Yeah. It's a question of whether or not their desire to shoot for the impossible is motivated by naivete about why it's impossible or by thinking that they see a gap in the completeness of our model. And in fact, you know, Tesla is a great example. Tesla, who was extremely successful at bringing things many thought impossible to fruition, and yet kind of hopeless in defending his own cause. He and Edison are a wonderful comparison, because Edison was a brilliant businessman and ruthless and died very, very rich. And Tesla was probably substantially more brilliant, but died penniless because he cared less about that aspect of it, and he wasn't good at defending his own interests. And so, you know, his wealth that he generated ended up in Westinghouse's pocket, not his own. But there's something to the idea of, somebody should probably catalog, and probably they have already, and I just don't know exactly where to look for it, but there's got to be a catalog of things people said were impossible that have now been accomplished. And, you know, they're all beautiful. Anytime somebody accomplishes things that others were sure couldn't be done, the story of how they got there is inevitably interesting. And so anyway, the last thing I want to do is shout down the tiny number of people who actually might be able to jump one of these impossible gaps on the basis that, you know, on the basis that everybody knows that's impossible.
So arrogance... Yeah, I don't know if arrogance is the right word or not. But
it's not. Arrogance is the pathological version. But if you go around telling people arrogance is bad. What is arrogance? Oh, it's overestimating what you're capable of. Mm-hmm. And then the person tries to wield that definition. They don't wield it, recognizing they're not in a good position to assess what other people are necessarily capable of.
And it's so, a form of arrogance itself.
That's right. That's right. It is a form of generic arrogance that we empower people with to go shout down others who have some kind of ambition to break some limit that nobody's broken yet.
It's odd how judgments, when they're wielded, they blind the wielder to that exact judgment, that they end up in the blind spot of the judgment that they're making about everybody else.
Well, this raises an important point. So there's a technique that comes out of the rationalist community called steel manning. And steel manning is the opposite of straw manning. Straw manning is painting your opponent's position as weaker than it is so that you can then defeat it. Steel manning is painting your opponent's position as strongly as you can in order to make sure that you are not cheating when you defeat it. So people who are really careful thinkers are frequently excellent, and maybe always excellent, at understanding the critique as well as those who are delivering it understand it. And the ability to speak your opponent's position so that they can recognize it and that they feel good about the way it was presented before you show why it's wrong is very powerful. It's not easy, but it's very powerful. And that's something that we should be teaching, right? Understand what your opponent is saying before you show why they're wrong. And it's really the heart of a good analytical education.
And that's what makes the judgment, I guess, 360. You're not just using the judgment to gain power or to be right, but to assure that everybody is right. And that's probably what's persuasive about it. You've done so much, you've sunk so much work into understanding the other side that you've kind of taken your own self out of the equation almost, or you've extended yourself into the other camp as far as possible.
Well, it it goes to this, I still don't know quite what to make of it, but when I was confronted by the students when they showed up at my classroom on May 23rd of last year, I said something in that hallway.
Where history pivoted?
Well, I said something that I remember hearing myself say it and thinking, it's odd that you would say that here. It's something I said in classrooms with some regularity, but I said that I was interested in dialectic and not debate.
Yeah.
Dialectic being the process of discovering what's true through argumentation rather than the attempt to win the argument for its own sake. And that process is why steel manning a position makes so much sense. That if the purpose of the argument is that those who are participating or watching come away enhanced by what they know, then having every position portrayed at full strength before any conclusion is reached is good for everybody. And so, anyway, hopefully steel manning will move from being a niche product to being a mainstream phenomenon sooner rather than later, because we all stand to benefit a lot from it.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.